Support for Prairie Public is provided by BNC National Bank, dedicated to providing financial solutions for businesses and consumers throughout the region. More information online at bnc.bank. And by Josh Beauchet, broker and realtor with Real Broker LLC, with a team of agents serving homebuyers, sellers, and investors throughout North Dakota, the Detroit Lakes area, and Northwest Minnesota. Josh can be reached at 701-367-3513.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Coming up in the second half of today's show, our weekly news discussion with Dave Thompson. But we're starting with the end of the school year. Summer is nigh upon us. Time for a road trip. Sounds great. Can be difficult to execute, especially if you have kids. We get tips from travel writer Alicia Underly-Nelson. Alicia, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, we've all heard this before. Are we there yet? Are we there yet? Are we there yet? Are we I might be guilty of doing that even into my 40s. So we're here today to talk about road trips, and especially as we get ready for summer road trips. I feel like it's more a crash course in survival than in how to travel.
Well, it doesn't have to be, though. If we don't plan it, it is something to survive, and okay, it is a rite of passage. But if we can plan it ahead of time, that takes a lot of the stress out of it.
Okay. So set us up for success here. When you say plan it, are you talking route or more than that?
Plan route, but also visualize what you're going to need every step of the way. That sounds a little new agey and strange, but I always like to think athletes like to visualize what happens, the outcome of their game. They visualize the plays they're going to run. They visualize how they're going to work together,
this,
how they're going to feel, the confidence they're going to feel on the court or on the ice.
You're manifesting.
Yeah, I think we can do that when we're stepping into a road trip situation too. So much of the time, we really concentrate on getting there, and we don't think about the process of getting there. We maybe manage to fuel the car, but we don't fuel ourselves. So are we bringing enough snacks? Are we bringing enough water? As a parent, you really can never have enough water and enough snacks. This is especially true if you're traveling on a family road trip or if there's a group. It's great to have everybody kind of pack their own and have everything accessible in one place. I actually just did a quick little interview with my cousin who had taken a trip. This wasn't a road trip necessarily. They did fly out to the coast with her family. And we were kind of talking about how the key is not to have one person burdened down with all the planning and all the carrying, because that often gets to be one person is sort of the pack mule of the group, and that can be very exhausting. So with kids or adults, empower people to pack their own snacks, keep their devices, get them charged up before they go. When I travel with my son, who is almost 11, we have his chargers. They are always out when we pack, and there's a special little container that they go into. We anticipate that when we get in the car or on the plane or whenever we're traveling or maybe in the hotel room when we arrive, that he's going to want to grab those things out first.
Oh, yeah. So it's like when I leave the grocery store and the candy bar is at the top of the bag so I can eat it on the way home.
Right, right. Yes. So if you know you're going to want that candy bar a half an hour down the road, it doesn't make sense to put that
seconds
in the trunk. But that's what we do. We think, oh, we're going to pack the car most efficiently, but we're not packing it for how we're actually going to use the thing. So if we know the kids start fussing for snacks, or if we know they start fighting over tablets, why are we bringing one tablet? Guess what? We're going to borrow one. We're going to check one out. We're going to take one from a friend. Maybe we're going to relax our screen time requirements a little bit and everybody gets their own.
You know, I never thought about that. Check one out. Is that standard at a library? To expose my ignorance here.
Some places do it. Some places do borrow. I'm also in a buy nothing group, so it's pretty common that you can say, I'm requesting a tablet or something like that. So if people have them, they will pass them along. I've seen Game Boys and things like that offered. Sometimes it doesn't have to be the same system people use at home, just kind of something new and novel and interesting.
Fascinating.
If you have little kids, it's also very fun. I'm a big fan of going to the dollar store when I travel with my nephews and niece and my son. And everybody gets, when they were little, it was coloring books and things of that nature. Now that they're older, it might be stickers or like kind of color by number things or that kind of thing. It's still fun to do something interesting and novel and to have activities to keep yourself busy.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so it's not just packing these things, but it's also keeping them accessible. So if I had a dollar for every time somebody said I packed a great carry-on for a plane, and then
and
I put it all at
the bottom.
Yeah, the snacks are at the bottom. They're completely pulverized. That doesn't do any good. And that can happen on road trips too.
Yeah.
We get all that stuff set. Oh, we put the backpacks in the back because that's where they fit the best.
Yeah.
And I am famous when we travel, as I will tell my husband, like all backpacks are in the front, right? They have to be like arm's reach that nobody's having to turn around in the car. Lots of times I will road trip with my son and I am the only adult and I am the driver. So he has to have everything that he needs. He's also the one that disperses. He might disperse the snacks.
Mm-hmm.
Have a garbage bag handy. Have paper towels handy. Lots of napkins, lots of wipes if you need them. All these little things.
I definitely have gotten ice cream on the ceiling of my car. I don't even know how.
I've gotten iced coffee in more places than I care to admit. So prepare for those disasters. And I always tell people, you don't have to reinvent the wheel. There are packing lists online. There are packing lists whenever I give presentations that I hand out. I have some on my site, prairiestylefile.com. And you don't have to keep redoing this every time. Print them out if that's your style. I have a note on my phone that I update. Just keep it low stress and empower everybody to do their own thing. You can check over the packing if you're the packing parent or the packing person or the planner in your friend group.
Mm-hmm.
You can help people check things over. But ultimately, when we know we're responsible for ourselves, we take a little bit more we pay a little bit more attention to what we actually do need.
Does it make any sense to have something like a master trip checklist? And I'm thinking just like an Excel document, or you could even handwrite this where it's like every trip, okay, you need the passport, you need the snacks, you need the chargers, you need the blah, blah, blah. And then maybe, okay, this time we need a swimsuit, this time we need snowshoes.
I think that's super helpful. And use those base lists as a start, or even just the next time you get back from a trip, unpack, make a list of what you brought, and make a list of what you wish you would have brought.
A lot of engineering.
Yep.
So
I have a different
such a skill.
I have a different list for camping kind of trips. Mm-hmm. And we don't full camp. We don't tent camp. We'll do like the cabins in state parks.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll have to bring some items, but not everything.
Yeah.
And it can help to consult with somebody. If I were to take a full camping trip, I would consult with people that camp all the time because they're going to have more info than I do. I'm going to consult books. I'm going to consult websites, that sort of thing. But it can really help to have a master list for yourself, for your family. And if you're traveling with a group of friends, a group of adults, to look ahead. If you're staying in a hotel, you're going to need a lot. If you're staying in an Airbnb, you might not need nearly as much. And maybe you'll look and say, okay, there's a few odds and ends that we need. Who has room? Who can bring? And just kind of break it down.
Mm. We're visiting today with travel writer Alicia Underlee Nelson. You can find out more about her at prairiestylefile.com. I want to go back to talking about snacks because I've actually been on a lot of trips and every single time I go, why didn't I pack snacks? They're so expensive on the road. And God help you if you're looking for something even remotely healthy. So what are some of your favorite snacks?
My husband always teases me because there's that commercial that aired for a while about people turning into their parents. And I am the person that brings the big giant bag of snacks because airport snacks are so expensive. But the same thing happens in gas stations. It's always something very salty or very fried. You will never find a fruit or a vegetable. So actually learning to pack for a toddler was one of the best things I did for myself.
Oh, yeah.
Because
the mom purse.
Yeah. I'm never hungry now. So I'm a big fan. Nuts keep really well.
Mm-hmm.
If you need something sweet, M&Ms don't melt, so that's pretty handy. Crackers, bring those at your own risk. Little containers are okay. Not too many. You bring the big thing of crackers. The box might keep it safe, but they kind of pulverize all over
mm-hmm.
a car, so be a little careful with those.
Yeah.
I also am a big fan of the pouches of applesauce. Those are great. And we often travel with mixes for like little individual mixes for iced tea or lemonade or something hydrating that you can mix in with water. We always travel with a water bottle and refill those. I'm not a fan of buying bottled water if I can help it.
Mm-hmm.
But you do need to hydrate a little bit more than you might think you need to on a road trip.
Why?
I think just if you're flying, you get dried out. If you're driving, you're probably having a lot of salty or sugary snacks. The air can be dry. Maybe you've got the air conditioning going in the summer. Maybe you're stopping and I always recommend stopping There's definitely.
Did you look at my next list of.
There's definitely folks that are a big fan of, we're going to drive this sucker straight through. And I can. I went to school in Bloomington, Illinois. I've driven about 11 hours from home. Mm-hmm. It is possible to do, but it's not enjoyable. And if you're taking a road trip, either by yourself or with people that you love, that is part of the experience. So you don't want this feeling to be torture. So it is okay to stop. I'm a big fan of getting a state park pass if you're going to be traveling mainly in one state and taking your breaks in a state park, taking a little picnic or a mini hike, that sort of thing. Stopping often and using the restroom. Sometimes it's fun, not necessarily to snack at gas stations or truck stops, but to look at fun souvenirs or buy some baked goods or that kind of thing. People watch a little bit, play the license plate game. Get out, move
you
around.
Never see Hawaii.
Like, I am not a fan of when people road trip and they don't let anybody eat or drink anything because we're not going to stop for 6 hours. Nobody can use the bathroom. You know what? We would never do that to each other in a stationary space. So why are we doing it to each other in a move? Like, it's going to be an extra. Even if you have a car full of kids, it's not going to take that long. And keeping everybody sane and happy and healthy is so worth it. So this is for all the people who are the ruthless navigators that just want to get there. Allow yourself a little extra time. If you need to move the start time up a little bit, that's cool. But you need to take breaks, not just for the car, but for the humans on the trip. They are more important than making that time.
We're visiting today with travel writer Alicia Underlie-Nelson. And Alicia, I want to talk to you about something that you said earlier about having your son not just be in charge of his own snacks, but especially if you're the only adult in the car and you're kind of delegating things to him. And when my daughter was maybe 10-ish, we started not leading the way through an airport or the subway or what have you. And we started saying, okay, we need to catch, you know, this connection out of wherever we are, and made her lead the way. And to the point that we weren't even telling her when she was doing something wrong. Like, that's not the FCON course at all, dear. What are some other little things that we can be doing to turn kids into savvy travelers?
I love that, because that is the goal. We don't want them just to be along for the ride, magically deposited places. We want them to understand the process from planning all the way through the experience. So I really involve kids, be it my son, nieces and nephews. I really involve them in the planning. So we'll get a big stack of books, and I'll suggest some websites, or maybe we'll watch a movie on the place that we're going, and we'll say, what are you excited to see? And then this is the important part that I recommend everybody do, whether it's with kids or with adults that you're traveling with. Everybody makes a list of what they're interested in, the kinds of experiences they want to have, the things they want to see. It doesn't have to be long, you know, two or three things. And then we prioritize those things. So it's not one person's will, a parent or the planner or the person who's spending the most money, if it's maybe grandma or grandpa helping fund this for everybody. Everybody gets a say. Then everybody's emotionally invested. Then before that child even gets in the car or gets on a plane or gets on a train, they're already envisioning what's happening. They're getting excited about it. Then when they're packing, you think about what they might need. So if you're already talking, great, we're going to be doing some hiking. Maybe they have special hiking gear. Maybe that's part of the process in getting some hiking gear. Maybe you do some trail hikes close to home and they think about what they need or what kind of snacks they like to have. Then they can pack those. Mm-hmm. And as you're traveling, the act of traveling can be really, really fun for kids. My son loves maps, and there's lots of maps when you travel. He also loves apps. So we have navigated many buses and trains from our phones and from old-fashioned, you know, paper schedules. So we took a trip with.
Whoa, he knows how to read a paper bus schedule.
We're getting there.
Wow, I don't know how to do
and
that.
They still have them. We took a trip to Chicago when he was six with friends, and you know, we were showing them, this is, you get on the bus this way. It goes north in this direction when you're standing on this side of the street, south on the other side. Those are lessons that transfer. You know, directionality transfers to all kinds of public transit. That's mm-hmm. useful to know.
Yeah.
And just to have him, lots of times I will be in a new city, and if I have not studied the transit map, I will stand there and gloss over it. Because the time to look at a transit map for the first time is not when you're standing in the station. The time is to do it before. Yeah. And I often travel with a little notebook, and I will cut out a map or shrink it down so I can see that, okay, here's the red line. We're in Chicago. The red line goes to here with about three or four stops so that I can look at it without looking like a tourist with a big, giant paper map unfolding like an accordion. Mm-hmm. But I just have a little idea, and that's a really easy thing to show to a kid. Okay, we're going to this airport. We're flying into LaGuardia. We're going to be landing in Terminal 2. Okay, it looks like we'll probably typically land in one of these gates. So how do you think the best way to get – oh, look at that. We get to take a train between terminals, for instance. And I don't even know if that's the right example for this particular airport, but you get the point.
Yeah.
And kids are excited then.
Having just flown out of JFK, yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of trains between terminals there.
Yeah, so people are really excited about, like, okay, great. I get to have this experience. I know this is coming. Oh, don't forget, Mom. Don't forget, Auntie, that this is happening. We get to go here now. And just the fact that they know that, I think, mm-hmm. is really exciting. And explaining to them how things are going to happen, where we're going to stop, showing them the map of where you're going.
Yeah.
My son and I drove to Green Bay for a trip, and he plotted out where we would stop. Giving kids control over that is great. I said, this is about how many miles to the gallon our car gets. So we're going to need to stop somewhere in here. When you're planning a trip, you're going to need to figure this out too. We can wing it. That's fine. Or if there's something that you want to see in either of these places, we can do that. Maybe sometimes he wants to stop. Maybe it's not real interesting and he's going to press on. Giving him some agency in the situation, letting him steer that a little bit is really fun.
Yeah. What kind of advice do you have when it's a group of friends?
Oh, when it's a group of friends, the planning matters too. But I really recommend making that fun. What can happen in a group of friends if you're not careful is nobody wants to take the planning position. Nobody wants to be like the one that bosses everybody else around. People are sensitive to that. So sometimes what happens is we don't plan anything. Mm-hmm. And then that can be tricky because we've not communicated what our goals for the trip are or what our boundaries are. So I think it's really helpful to get everyone together. If you normally have a game night or you normally go out to brunch, bring it up. Say, hey, we're going to take 20 minutes and we're going to kind of hammer this out. Usually groups of friends will do this when they pick a destination and they will start to have these conversations about, what do we want to spend? What dates work for people? You'll begin to touch on those conversations. But then once you have that selected, really sit down and say, what does a busy day look like to you? Because for some people, a busy day might mean, oh man, we committed to a dinner reservation at 8:00. And for other people, a busy day might mean we are up at 7:00 and we take the first tour at 8:00 and then we're having lunch and then we're meeting you for dinner. And if you don't know what busy means to your group before you show up, someone is going to get woke up very early and be really unhappy about it. Or someone's going to be bored out of their mind waiting for the day to start. And you don't want that to happen. You don't need that kind of tension.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think it's smart to talk about money as well. A lot of times people will say, we just want to have an affordable experience. I mean, we'll go a little crazy. We can have some fun nights out, or we can go to the club, or we can splurge a little bit on this particular trip. But what's extravagant to one person might be a bargain to someone else. And sometimes we don't see those things. If you live in North Dakota or Western Minnesota, there's not a lot of price variation. So the difference between a very cheap restaurant and a wildly expensive restaurant is not that huge. You start going to some other countries or other cities, someone might sit down and see an $87 entree and panic. So we have the ability to do some of that research ahead of time. And I think it's really important. We value these friendships. We don't want anybody to feel overextended. We don't want anyone to feel stressed. And we don't want anyone to panic, and we don't want anyone to have to go along with things and feel resentful about it.
Yeah.
And the biggest thing too is once people say, we're really trying to commit, maybe they have a very strict budget. Hey, we're spending $100 a day or $200 a day, or we don't want to spend any more than this at dinner. Then as a group, you have to go, all right. And maybe you split up.
Yeah.
That's fine, because I think there's a focus on sameness, especially when you're traveling with equals, with people that you're used to hanging out with. You assume everybody's going to want to do the same thing. And I had an experience. I went to Amsterdam. Two couples went. And I really wanted to go to the Anne Frank house. I'm in Amsterdam. I can't not go. This is central to my experience here. And another person in the group was much more interested in the herbal refreshments in Amsterdam. And for him, that was like, that was the point of Amsterdam. Mm. And someone else was really tired and just wanted to have a rest. And my husband was very curious about TV. He was really intrigued. And he wanted to sit in the hostel and see what was on TV and meet people from around the world and have a beer. And so we split up. And that's important because we all would have been really frustrated with everybody else's choice for that afternoon.
Yeah.
So sometimes you split up. It's not the end of the world if a couple goes out to dinner alone, or if you branch off and you go shopping and someone else goes out to that expensive dinner. It's your trip. You can do what you want. And if you have those conversations early and often and you revisit them and you respect somebody's boundary, you don't say, oh, come on, you're on vacation, and try to guilt trip people. If you say, we're going to stick to where we're committed to spending and what we're committed to doing. And yeah, there's room to play. There's room to goof around. There's room to blur those lines a little bit. But if everybody gets to have the experience that they want and nobody feels pressured, everybody's happier. And then you have more to talk about when you come back.
How do you strike the balance, Alicia, on a road trip between, okay, efficiency, take the interstate, maybe more fun, go on some side roads, see something, you know, the world's most giant basket or whatever.
I am a big fan of the concept of travel speeds, and this came when I took my first trip abroad with some high school friends of mine to visit a friend of ours that lived in Spain. And my dear friend, Carrie, everywhere we would go, she would stop and say, can we sit in those chairs? Can we sit in that park? And we thought, this girl is obsessed with where you can and can't sit in Madrid. How strange. And our 17-year-old selves did not understand that she's our good friend, and she's a Midwestern woman. So when she's saying, what's the deal with all these chairs? She's really trying to say, can we stop walking for 10 seconds and sit? I need to sit. And we had been friends our whole lives. We grew up together. And for us, for three of us, and our Spanish friend and my best friend, Liz, and I, a day of, you know, a casual walking, a moderately active day was 7 to 10 miles. And that was our travel speed. The three of us clicked together perfectly. We never would have known this if we had not traveled together. Because living in a small town where you had to drive everywhere, you can walk the whole town in 20 minutes, we had never had any need to discuss this with each other. How long is too long? Who knows? We've never had any cause to walk 7 to 10 miles in our lives. And nor did Carrie. And she realized very soon that her travel speed was slower. Her ideal travel speed would have involved less walking, more stopping, more people watching, more cute little cafes. We didn't know that we could even have that conversation. We got better as the trip went on, thank goodness. And I think we were all very grateful about it. And we were young enough to realize what we didn't know and not to be worried about it. And I think that's key. So you need to look at each other and think, what is our travel speed realistically? If you're insisting that you stick together as a group, you are only as fast as your least mobile member. Now, that can be a toddler. That can be the parent that has a child strapped to their chest. That can be great-grandma in a walker or a wheelchair. It can be cousin Jaden who's in a walking boot. Whoever that is, that's the speed that you're going, unless you make other plans. So that is a very literal definition of travel speed. You start there, and then you start saying, how busy is busy? Are you an introvert or are you an extrovert? You know, if you've got a lot of introverts in the car, maybe you're going slower. Maybe you're not stopping as much and doing all those road trippy things. Maybe they're okay with just getting there and everybody can bury their face in their audiobooks or their crossword puzzles and we're cool with being a little bit more efficient. I think it really depends on the personality of the people that you're traveling with. It depends on your goals and it depends on how easy it is for people to get in and out of the car, you know? And how often people need to get in and out of the car. That guides everything.
Travel writer Alicia Underlee Nelson. You can follow her at prairiestylefile.com. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Extra, extra, read all about it. Gather around everybody. I'm gonna tell you a story.
And with that music,
We bring in Dave Thompson for our weekly review of the news. Dave is our news director here at Prairie Public. Dave, good to visit with you again.
Thank you, Craig. Good to be here.
And again, we're pitching a doubleheader with you this week, Dave.
Yep,
we talked to you yesterday about the gubernatorial debate that you moderated on Tuesday. And I'd like to start right there, Dave. Any more fallout, if you will, from the debate that was on Tuesday? It's been characterized as maybe a lost opportunity, at least for the lieutenant governor, to make a name for herself and offer contrast between Representative Kelly Armstrong and, of course, the sitting lieutenant governor is Tammy Miller, who's seeking the nomination.
We're hearing from columnists. We're hearing from other politicals who are wondering what actually was accomplished by that debate. We tried very hard to get them to, you know, really compare and contrast where they stand on the issues, but there's a lot of similarity between the two candidates.
Well, the primary is coming up in June, so we urge potential voters to learn as much as they can about the candidates from various means, Dave.
And I'm glad you brought that up, because in a primary, if you're going to vote for the statewide races, you have to vote the party ticket as a Republican or as a Democrat. When you get down to the races that are, you know, going to be local races, then you don't have to. But when you come to a primary election polling site, you will be asked, do you want the Republican ballot or the Democratic ballot?
Thanks, Dave, for that. Let's move forward to nuclear power. We talked a little bit about this before. There's a concern about still nuclear waste. What's the latest relative to at least looking seriously at bringing nuclear power to North Dakota?
Well, you're talking about a situation where you've got these data centers and they're big users of power, and there are more projects perhaps in the pipeline to come to North Dakota. So the Department of Commerce is the one who said, we ought to look at these, you know, smaller nuclear units, not like the big nuclear units, but the smaller nuclear units, maybe 50 to 100 megawatts, that type of thing. And that could help with, you know, power to these projects. The Public Service Commission chairman said that's all well and good, but he says before you do that, find a place to store nuclear waste. I believe Xcel is storing nuclear waste at its two Minnesota plants on site. You know, that whole back to what happened in Nevada with Yucca Mountain and all the controversy over that. And there's not a real solution yet in terms of nuclear waste storage.
And that problem's been around for a long time.
For an awful long time, yes.
I think I've noted before that in Wyoming, they were looking at what was called monitored retrievable storage to store nuclear waste temporarily and then move it to Yucca Mountain later. But that never came to fruition. The governor decided that he was worried about transporting nuclear waste in the state. So this is a problem. It's a national problem, Dave.
Yeah, the idea of transport, that has not really been discussed yet, but that could be an issue in North Dakota as well.
Dave, the University of North Dakota, they're working to train more air traffic controllers. This is certainly a needed vocation.
You're talking about a lot of people coming up on retirement age for air traffic controllers, but it's really tough. You go through a program right now at UND for air traffic control or air traffic management, then you have to go to more training for a couple of years. So now they're trying to figure out, is there a way we can streamline this so that you can get these people into the workforce quicker, because there's going to be the need. There's a need for more air traffic controllers. There's a need for all sorts of aviation workers. And there are efforts to see if there's some way that you can streamline that.
And the FAA, Dave, requires that air traffic controllers retire at age 56. So
that's correct. I would have had retired 11 years ago.
I would have retired a few years ago. Maybe not 11, but a few years ago. Dave, it's a time we should start thinking about severe weather, and your staff has been reporting about that.
Absolutely. If you take a look at that, the insurance commissioner has been basically saying you need to prepare, and you need to look at flood insurance and other house insurance to prepare for severe weather. This week, there were a number of, if you heard tornado sirens, yes, they were testing them out statewide to make sure they work as we get into the severe summer weather awareness.
Dave, there's a new initiative from the MHA Nation to allow tribal members to register as organ donors on their tribal IDs. This is an important story.
There's been a little bit of reluctance to allow that to happen, but we had the Turtle Mountain do it. And now they're saying, we want to expand this to other Native Americans to give them the choice. It's your choice if you want to be an organ donor or not. But they do say that when you get to the hospital, a majority of Native Americans who are in the hospital turn down being an organ donor. So they're trying to get some awareness of the importance of organ donation.
Your staff reported that this initiative was inspired by the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa, who became the first tribe
first
in the country
tribe, yes.
to add organ donation registrations to their tribal IDs in 2022.
If you have a state driver's license in North Dakota, you have the choice already to become an organ donor or not. But in the tribes, they want to put that on the tribal ID cards.
Dave, American Crystal Sugar was fined for air quality violations. This was a significant fine.
$350,000, which the company has paid. They had too many emissions, and this concerned their plant at Grand Forks. So they've made some improvements, and they have to prove to the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, because the plant is actually East Grand Forks, to prove that they've cut down on emissions, and they're working to do that.
And the emissions of concern were hydrogen sulfide, is that right?
Correct. That's H2S.
Thanks for the chemistry lesson, Dave.
That's what I remember from my chemistry classes.
Well done.
That's it.
The University of North Dakota, Dave, is set to receive millions of dollars from the federal government to study the possibility of using captured carbon dioxide to pump more oil out of the Bakken Foundation.
This is amazing, because there is talk about using CO2 to get it out of the Bakken. Now, we know that CO2 can be used to enhance oil recovery in what are called the legacy wells. So there's more research being done. Can that also be done on a Bakken well? And the Bakken wells have interesting challenges, perhaps, because they are quite deep. And there's a natural gas to oil ratio. As oil production goes down, natural gas production goes up. So how does this all, you know, work into enhanced oil recovery? And EERC probably is uniquely situated to do this research. Everybody is saying in the oil business, enhanced oil recovery is going to keep the industry going long past what it would be considered to be its due date or done date, because you can get more oil out of the ground if these techniques work.
Dave, the skyline, I guess, of Bismarck has changed just a little bit. That iconic Hangar Number 5 is coming down at the Bismarck Airport. This building is more than 80 years old.
Absolutely, and has been used a lot for general aviation, but has outlived its usefulness. And we all knew it. We all saw it, you know, when we go to the airport or drive past the airport in Bismarck. And to see it go down, well, you know, change is hard sometimes, because I remember it growing up.
Dave, what else is your team working on?
Well, of course, we've got more preparation for potential debates. We're also talking about some of the issues in some of the races. I am really going to attempt to finally get the finishing touches on this story about how the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library went from Dickinson to Medora, and what happened behind the scenes.
We'll look forward to hearing from you, Dave.
Thank you much.
Gather around, everybody. I'm gonna tell you a story.
It's our news director, Dave Thompson, here at Prairie Public. Thank you, Dave.
Thank you.
More Main Street is ahead. Stay with us.
Students camping at the main lawn at Columbia University are protesting the war in Gaza. How does their protest echo the anti-Vietnam War protest on the same campus in 1968? Tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
4 a.m. Central to 9 a.m. Central here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Take a snapshot of small-town journalism's heartbeat. Let's say we are in Mount Vernon, Iowa. In this report from Harvest Public Media, we'll see a unique transition where the Daily Iowan, a student newspaper, steps in to purchase the Sun, embodying a fresh approach amidst the ongoing challenges in the newspaper industry, and we're seeing some of those challenges right here in North Dakota. Harvest Public Media's Jim Meadows reports.
Mount Vernon, Iowa has the quintessential Midwestern downtown, with a cafe, a bank, and a local newspaper. The office of the Mount Vernon Lisbon Sun faces First Street, the word newspaper written in fancy white letters on the front window. Inside the newspaper office, it's another busy day for editor Nathan Countryman.
Finishing up calendar, finishing up the special section. So I've got two stragglers I've got to track down, which is always fun.
The paper serves two small towns in eastern Iowa, surrounded by farmland. Last February, Countryman learned that his paper was being sold. In an unusual move, the University of Iowa student newspaper, The Daily Iowan, a private nonprofit company, bought The Sun and another rural weekly. The new owners are keeping the staff and providing some student reporters to help out, which is good news for Countrymen.
It's a lot more breathing room in those regards. It's an ability to have a Monday where I can say, I just need somebody else to cover the city council meeting.
The Daily Iowan's experiment comes as many newspapers are shrinking, merging, or closing. The local news initiative at Northwestern University has data going back to 2005. Director Tim Franklin says the decline has hit hardest in rural areas in the South, Southeast, and Midwest.
You can almost draw a straight line from the Texas-Mexico border, from, say, Brownsville, Texas, up through the spot, what I call the spine of the country. And with some exceptions, almost all the counties are either news deserts or one news outlet counties.
Franklin says declining readership and ad revenue have hurt newspapers everywhere, but it's harder for papers to stay afloat where fewer people live.
In rural areas, the problem is one of scale. Are there enough paying customers in a smaller rural community to be able to support journalism in that area?
In Ford County, Illinois, population 13,500, the weekly Ford County Chronicle is run on a for-profit basis, although no one's getting rich.
It's hard, but every job's hard, right?
That's Will Brumley, the editor, reporter, and co-publisher of the Chronicle, a rare example today of a new newspaper replacing an old one. He and another former employee of a much older local paper started the Chronicle in 2020. Brumlevy says it's a financial risk, but they're devoted to the community.
There's not that many jobs that like make you feel better about the difference you can make in other people's lives and just try to keep people informed of things they need to know. You know, it's important.
Another publisher is trying to fill a news desert in rural West Texas. John Starkey runs a nonprofit media organization in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. Last year, he bought the Ozona Stockman in Crockett County, 300 miles away. He plans to expand the paper to cover seven rural counties, some of which have no news outlets at all.
They have spotty internet, they have spotty radio reception, and they have restricted TV because of the geographic parameters of the area. So if they don't have a newspaper, they don't have news. It's that simple.
New business models for newspapers like the Stockman are key as ad revenues slide. That's according to Benji Hamm. He's director of the University of Kentucky's Institute for Rural Journalism and Community Issues. But he doesn't expect things to change overnight.
There will be more newspapers that go out of business. There will be more online sites that determine they can't make a profit. But I think there will continue to be things that emerge to replace that.
And journalists dedicated to local news. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Jim Meadows.
Harvest Public Media is a collaboration of public media newsrooms in the Midwest and Great Plains, including Prairie Public. More Main Street is ahead.
Viva la Italia, the final season concert of the Missouri Valley Chamber Orchestra is set for Sunday, April 28th at 3 p.m. The program titled Italian Serenade features excerpts from the comic opera Elixir of Love with guest artists soprano Melissa McCann and tenor Sebastian Habotsky. The orchestra also presents serenades full of Italian lyricism, drama, and energy. The concert will be held at Shepherd of the Valley Lutheran Church in Bismarck. Tickets are available at the door.
Each week we play the fanfare, and that means it's time to go to the movies with our in-house movie reviewer, Matt Olien. Matt, welcome back to Main Street.
Hi, Craig.
This is an interesting movie, Matt, you're taking us to this week called Housekeeping for Beginners, story of a young woman who takes a job as a housekeeper in a quaint yet mysterious town. But to me, it looks like a story about love. Did you like the movie?
I liked it enough, yeah. This is a film from Macedonia, as you probably know, and it was their entry. Each country gets to submit a film for consideration for the Oscars for the International Feature Film Award, and only five get nominated. It did not make the final five, but it is Macedonia's entrance. Written, directed, and edited by Goran Stilevski, starring Anna Maria Marinka as Dita. And Dita is the main character in the movie. She is white, so Eastern European white, and a lot of the people in the house she's living in, I would say, are... There's a lot of racial thing in this movie, and if you don't know much about Eastern Europe, Macedonia, she lives in a house with people of kind of gypsy descent, I would say. That word is mentioned in the movie. And gypsies have long been looked down upon, frowned on, as you know, Craig, in Eastern Europe. They have a long history of kind of, you know, being these drifters, really. That's kind of at play here, too. And she's forced into almost kind of taking care of these two daughters because the mother dies. And so she is forced to be the mother in this incredibly dysfunctional household. There's people coming and going left and right. It feels almost like a college house. There's so many characters. There's two male characters who are lovers. You know, one of the male characters is really bonded to one of the little girls, even though he's not related to her. There's other people coming and going, so it feels like a mess. It feels chaotic, and the film feels chaotic as well. It's a lot of handheld camera work. There's a lot of jumping around. There's a lot of characters. It might be hard for American audiences to follow, but in the end, I think it's a film about what is a family. And increasingly, I think family can be defined in a lot of different terms. It doesn't have to be traditional. This is not even close to being traditional. I won't go too much into the plot to reveal things of what's going on with all these people in the house and what Dita has to overcome, but she is the main character. The fact that she's white is kind of an issue in this movie, as she's living with a lot of people of like gypsy descent, non-white, I'll just say that. So that becomes a real kind of interesting issue. I liked it for the most part. I do think, though, that the film is so chaotic, and maybe that's the point. There's so many characters coming in and out that it feels chaotic, but that is the point. That there's a lot of houses like that. There's plenty of people that live like this, where people come and go, they stay for a week, they leave, and it's very tricky to raise kids in an environment like that. So overall, I did like it. It's a good slice of life of Eastern European Macedonia, I guess, if people want to go see that. One of these films, again, that the critics tend to like, the audience score is only 59%. And I will tell audiences, I saw this at the Fargo Theater, you're really going to have to pay attention. So you need to be in the right mood to see this, or it's a lot of stuff is going to go flying right over your head.
This is a movie that is subtitled.
Mm-hmm.
Matt, I've noticed personally when I watch a movie that has subtitles, I do pay attention in a more focused way and maybe take more from the movie because I'm reading the subtitles.
I focus all the time at a movie, but with subtitles, I think you really have to focus on the tone. What are they saying? How are they saying it? Because we don't understand the language. It feels like a student film. It feels like a film that students might have made. It's that kind of haphazardly edited together, sometimes too haphazardly edited. I felt there were times the film needed to breathe a little bit more. I mean, there's a lot of talking, people talking over each other, singing. And at some point, you want them to slow down a little. But again, I think this is the director's point. The point is, this is the chaos they live in every single day. How this gets resolved, you'll have to go see the movie. But it feels very much like an experimental student film that's supposed to be a narrative feature. So in that respect, it's a very unusual movie and one that I can't really compare anything else to in the last year. So I did like it, didn't love it. I can see why it didn't make the final five. I think it's a little too haphazard in terms of professional quality. Some of the acting is better than others. The little girl who plays Mia is one of the most adorable kids you'll ever see in a movie. The actress's name is Jada Salim. And she's the youngest kid that they all kind of take care of. I think it's a little too haphazard to make the final five. Some of the acting is okay. Some is not. This feels like a lot of unprofessional actors here. And that can be kind of a mixed bag. But again, it also helps us have a more realistic feel of what we're watching with this family. Family in quotes, I would say.
With those who were with you in the theater, did you get a sense on how the audience received this film? Was it kind of the 50-50, 60-40 type of thing that you were talking about earlier generally?
Two older women walked out within the first 20 minutes.
Wow.
They walked out right after a lovemaking scene that was going on. I think they did not know what they were in for. A friend of mine that went with me, Christine Hoper, was crying near the end. So for her, it worked. There was an emotional tug at the end of this film. And it's one of these movies you got to wait for the beats. You got to wait for the emotion to come, because at first it feels like you're just watching this crazy, dysfunctional frat house, sorority house, whatever you think you're watching. But just keep it going, because the emotions will come in the end. And overall, I would give it overall, I liked it. I don't think it's a great film. I think it's a little too unpolished and unprofessional in some parts. Acting is variable, but overall, I would recommend people see it, but pay attention.
I like that the Fargo Theater brings us films mm-hmm. like this, Matt. I think it's an important part of their mission. Am I correct about
that? You are very correct about that. It's long been one of their missions, for sure.
What's coming down the road from you, Matt, relative to movie reviews?
I think the movie Challengers is next with Zendaya. This is going to be an unusual career move for her, moving into more of a serious, looks like almost a sensual movie where she's involved with these two tennis players, and she's a tennis player as well. And it looks like kind of a combination sports art house movie. So we'll see about that next.
Matt, let's back up 30 years for our trivia question today. One of my favorite films of all time was not chosen mm-hmm. for the Academy Award in 1994, which was, and which two very popular films didn't win.
So Pulp Fiction did not win. Forrest Gump did win. I'm pretty sure you're saying Pulp Fiction is one of your favorites. No, Shawshank Redemption.
There you go.
So Shawshank became this huge cult film on cable television after it was released. It didn't make a lot of money at first. But yeah, Forrest Gump wins the Oscar. We can debate whether that was the right choice or not. I don't think it was 30 years later.
Matt, thank you for joining us again on Main Street.
Of course, Craig.
More Main Street's ahead. Stay with us.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 25th. One of the most inspiring Americans of the 20th century visited Fargo on this date in 1914. Helen Keller, who was left blind and deaf from sickness as a small child, spoke at First Methodist Church with her teacher and longtime companion, Ann Sullivan. They were lifelong friends. Helen Keller was a trailblazing advocate for people with disabilities. In 1914, she and Sullivan were on a lecture tour. Helen's mother traveled with them. One of their stops was Fargo, where they stayed at the Waldorf Hotel. The YWCA sponsored their appearance and took them on a tour of the city before the evening lecture. In anticipation of Keller's visit, a neighborhood social club read Keller's 1903 autobiography, The Story of My Life. At the time of the visit, Keller was 33 years old. The evening lecture was called The Heart and the Hand, or The Right Use of Our Senses. Tickets were $1. Students paid 50 cents. The Fargo Daily Courier News gave a glowing account of the lecture. The large church was filled with an overflowing crowd. Ann Sullivan spoke first. She recounted her teachings with Helen, learning to spell words, reading in Braille, writing letters to friends, and eventually learning to speak. Helen Keller spoke next for half an hour. She told the audience, "I am glad to stand before you and meet you in fellowship. I cannot hear your voices, but I feel your loving kindness, and it makes me happy." The newspaper reported she wanted to encourage others to make the most of their opportunities. Keller said, "The hands of others open the world to me. And by helping others, I find life beautiful." Keller also spoke of her Christian faith and her trust in God. Afterward, Ann Sullivan explained how Helen could understand speech by vibrations, a skill they demonstrated for the audience. The next day, the tour left Fargo for Winnipeg. Fargo was reportedly the smallest place on their itinerary. Ann Sullivan died in 1936, Helen Keller in 1968. Their ashes rest together at the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jack Dura. I'm Ann Olquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
And that's a wrap for today's episode of Main Street. We are grateful that you tuned in. A reminder, tomorrow in this time slot at 3 p.m. Central is The Middle with Jeremy Hobson. He asks the question, are you still feeling the effects of the COVID pandemic in your life? And at 7 p.m., we'll have Science Friday with Ira Flatow. Ashley, I'm taking a bit of a break from Main Street.
A well-earned one.
Thank you for that. I'm looking forward to it. But I know there's a lot that Main Street is looking forward to also beginning next Monday.
On Monday, we're going to talk with philosopher Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein as we take a look at DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion, and its impact on the workplace and our political beliefs and how we talk about our political beliefs as there is an increase in diversity in workplaces. That's a Monday on Main Street. Enjoy the rest of your weekend, and Craig, enjoy your vacation.
Thank you. I sure will, Ashley.